Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 383, an interview with Kevin Coogan being recorded on October 14th of 2002. Kevin is the author of, among other titles, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Postwar Fascist International, published in softcover by AutonoMedia.org. And, Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
And we're talking about the post-war fascist international and some of the interesting gradations in that. Although fascism is, of course, fundamentally at least a right-wing philosophy, it has, in many time periods, overlapped with and sort of flowed into left-wing, and particularly extreme left-wing conduits. And a couple of things that we were speaking about inside one. Three concepts I'd like you to tie together as quickly as you can. One is the concept of national Bolshevism, and also a related position, which is the third position. And you were mentioning a Russian neo-Bolshevik. His name began with D. I've forgotten off.
Dugin.
Dugin.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could perhaps relate national Bolshevism, third position, and then tie in Mr. Dugin for
us. Sure. As I was pointing out, there existed a trend in fascism in the 1920s and the 1930s that has been dubbed national Bolshevism. And the idea of national Bolshevism was to encourage essentially a geopolitical alliance between Russia and Germany. Now, this first really emerged in Germany. One of the people who was identified with this argument was a man named Ernst Junger. Another man who was prominent in promoting this idea was a former socialist, a former radical socialist turned rightist named Ernst Niekesch. And he had created a group called Resistance, or Widerstand in German. And this group was a very curious group because although it adopted many far-right positions, at the same time it was very close to Russia. And Niekesch was put in jail by the Nazis during the 1930s. And in fact, he stayed in jail until 1945. So there is this tendency, and it's a tendency that if people haven't heard of it, there's a very good reason, and it is because it's a relatively obscure tendency. So you might ask, well, why are we talking about it now? This is the 1920s and 1930s. What relevance does it have to the 1990s or to the year 2000? The real point is that inside the far right today, there are very significant groups that are now rediscovering and promoting the ideas of national Bolshevism and the concept of a German-Russian alliance. And in Germany, Horst Mahler is an important figure in this argument. Now, Horst Mahler's counterpart in Russia is a fellow named Alexander Dugin, D-U-G-H-I-N, I think is one way they transliterated it. Dugin created a publication called Octogaia. He also has an extensive website, and the website will link into many other websites, where he advocates this new rebirth of both national Bolshevism and a alliance between Russia and Europe against the United States. And he's a very prominent figure and a figure of some interest because right now Russia, under the Putin government, is still trying to decide how far it will ally with the United States and how far it would want to pursue an independent course. And just one example, the Dugin people argue that it's very important for Russia to have an independent relationship with Iran. And they suggest that one of the key ways to develop a central Russia is to maintain a special Russian-Iranian relationship in which transportation could go straight from from Iran into the former Soviet Union. So there are a lot of geopolitical chips that are on the table here, and one ideological support of this sort of geopolitical policy is this idea of national Bolshevism.
What one should bear in mind as we reflect on what's going on in the world as a whole on October 14th, that, of course, the United States' relationship with both Russia and its antipathy toward Iran, labeled part of the Axis of Evil by George Bush, is one of the political dynamics that's looming large on the world political stage right now, so that when we're talking about some of these seemingly obscure names, such as Mr. Dugin or National Bolshevism or people back from the 20s, such as Ernst Junger, in fact, these are ideological and geopolitical concepts that are at the very forefront of what's going on today.
And actually, if I could just put in a plug for a publication that has some very good discussion. There are two very good articles on this.
Sure.
The most recent publication of, it's called Patterns of Prejudice. And Patterns of Prejudice is based in London, and so in order to find it, you'd probably have to find it in a library, because its sales are essentially to libraries and research institutions in the United States.
Is this a periodical?
Yes, it's a periodical. It, okay. it comes out quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
Patterns of Prejudice in the summer issue, it's a special issue edited by Roger Griffin, who's a leading expert on fascism and the history of fascism, who teaches in England.
Is he also the guy? He's one of the editors of the Searchlight, is he not?
Well, he doesn't edit Searchlight. He has written, I think, an article or two for Searchlight,
uh-huh.
but he's not a direct editor of Searchlight. He's
okay.
more really of an academically oriented person.
Mm-hmm.
But he has a very good. You can go to Amazon.com and look up his anthologies, his anthologies on fascism of both the 1930s and today. He also has many books. But he organized a special issue on fascist groups, and I contributed an article on Yaqui and the European Liberation Front. But the two articles I really want to call attention to, there's a really good article by Jeffrey Bale, who's a research scholar, on a man named Christian Boucher and his group Nouvelle Resistance in France. And then there's another article by a man named Matthias Mattel, who's an expert on German-Russian relations. And he goes into great detail on people like Alexander Dugin. And one of the most important points he makes about Dugin is that Dugin really came to prominence with the support of elements both in the Stalinist elite and in the Russian military. And Dugin's ability to function at such a prominent level is reflected in his support from elements inside the old Soviet ruling establishment. And Mattel argues that after 1991, when the entire ideological structure of the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, when the coup failed and Yeltsin came to power, that many of these old power brokers in Russia were scrambling around to find a new ideology to justify their existence, and they glommed onto things like National Bolshevism.
Jeffrey Bale has written an article. Do you recall offhand? Is it the summer issue or what issue of Patterns of Prejudice was
summer,
that?
Summer of 2002.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that I also might add here, just as another little twist, is that Jeffrey Bale's article discusses Christian Boucher, who was a very prominent French leader of the French New Right, but he also mentions a group called it's a group of followers of a man named Jean Thiriart.
Let me just spell that briefly. It's Thiriart for members of the listening audience. Sure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And Thiriart was a very important figure who, right before his death, he died in 1992, he was actually at a conference in Moscow meeting with Alexander Dugin. In fact, in my book, in my Yaqui book, I have a picture of the two of them meeting in the former Soviet Union. Thiriart was another one of these fellows who was very strongly in favor of a geopolitical national Bolshevist axis between Russia and Germany. And he also, although he himself had been a former a member of a support group for the SDS, he had, after World War II, he was...
By the way, Kevin, let me just interject briefly. SDS, because we have some younger members of the audience who... That's the Students for a Democratic Society.
No, you misheard me. Sorry. If I said it incorrectly, then I said it incorrectly. He was a member of the SS, a support association for the SS.
Oh, okay.
During World War II.
Right.
He had been... Thiriart had been... again, he has, like so many of these people, a very checkered political career.
Mm-hmm.
In his youth, he had been a follower of the Communist Party. Then he switched in the late 1930s and became a strong supporter of fascism to such a degree that when the when World War II broke out, he became a member of a support group for the SS in Belgium. And in 1945, he was actually thrown in jail. I think he spent 4 years in jail for his collaboration with the Nazis.
Now, that the FSS, do you know offhand what that stands for?
The SS, the Nazi...
I see. He a friend of the SS, then.
Yes, exactly, right.
Yep.
In fact, he collaborated. He knew Otto Skorzeny from that time. He was a very significant figure in some of these networks during World War II, but he became even more significant after World War II because he became a sort of a liaison man for the kind of underground far right in Europe. And he also became very good friends with Juan Perón.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. when Juan Perón went into exile from Argentina and lived in fascist Spain during the 1960s.
One of the organizations that Tivia was active with was called Jeune Europe, and that was a Nazi/SS-connected organization, right?
Definitely, with one little footnote. What Thiriot had done by 64-65 was to really strongly move away from a lot of the imagery of the old Nazi period.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, he told his followers that because they backed a young Europe, the idea of young Europe was really a Yaqui-like idea of a kind of a European imperium. And one of the major problems in forming that European imperium was, in fact, Nazism, in the sense that so much of Nazism was based on racial blood ideology. And so for a guy like Thiriot, it was impossible to unite all of Europe under an ideology that considered, you know, the Italians inferior, the Greeks inferior, the et cetera, et cetera. And so he began very strongly complaining about the continued existence of sort of Hitler. He called it Hitlerite nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to such a degree that he did some astonishing things. For example, in the mid-1960s, he went to Romania and actually met with Chou Enlai, the Chinese prime minister, who was visiting Romania to visit Ceausescu, who was the Nicolae Ceausescu, who was the leader of Romania.
Mm-hmm.
Thiriot was very willing to form an alliance with the Chinese. If you look at his publication, which I have looked at, I met him. He gave me his publications when I met him in Brussels in 1987, I think. You'd be hard pressed to know that this was a far right group. In fact, he would have the cover of one of his publications had a picture of Che Guevara.
Mm-hmm.
They had signs saying, you know, U.S. out of Vietnam. They had pictures of Viet Cong guerrillas. He made a very strong pitch to the far left. And when we look at a guy like Horst Mahler today, you can see that again, Horst Mahler is not simply a unique phenomenon or just a quirky dude. There's a whole pattern of this attempted overture between far right and far left, which Thiriot represented. Now, what happened is that after he died, there was there were two factions who came out from his group. One faction more or less allied itself with this fellow Christian Boucher, but another group felt much more comfortable with a man named Luc Michel. And the reason why this is important is that today, Luc Michel and his own group pop up all over Europe. For example, if you look at a list of there's a committee right now to support Slobodan Milosevic, who's now being tried in The Hague for war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see, if you look at the list, you'll see, for example, like Ramsey Clark and other people who are conventionally considered leftists, on the board of this committee to defend Milosevic.
If I could just interject briefly, if that's why the reference that I misunderstood to the SDS, it was not as far out of context or as ludicrous as one might think.
No, unfortunately.
That is why I simply followed the lead on that, because there should be a lot of difference, but unfortunately there are strong areas of bleed over, and that's perhaps to be taken quite literally. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's as if the D is bleeding out of SDS.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But Luc Michel, for example, and his group are doing things like that. They also have a group that they named in honor of Nikesh called the Resistance or Widerstand, and they are trying right now very actively to form ties with the Party of Democratic Socialism, which is the party in Germany left over from East Germany, which is itself is a kind of a radical socialist party,
headed by Gregor Gysi, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, although there's a twist there that's a very intriguing twist, in that Gysi had also been a member of the Berlin ruling Social Democratic PDS coalition, and he was removed from that coalition about a month or two ago, after somebody claimed that he had used his frequent flyer miles in an improper way. So there are a lot of strange things going on inside inside Germany, inside the PDS in particular, just at this moment. But one of the strangest is the attempt of people like Luc Michel to make overtures to the PDS. And what's fueling all this is the pressure that many people in Europe are feeling, that we must resist the war of the United States against Saddam Hussein, at any cost. And so if a people from the far right, even if they're masquerading as leftists, if they're saying, hey, look, we too oppose, you know, a war with Iraq, it's tempting to some people in the left to sort of lower their guard and say and let these people into the camp, so to speak.
Going back to actually this dovetails to a certain extent with the discussion of Iraq. Going back to Tilyar and some of his liaisons and some of his fused ideology, in the 1960s he emerged with an ideological bent, so to speak, in which he actively courted various Middle Eastern leaders, among them a young Saddam Hussein, and also then an army officer, not yet the head of state, and also Yasser Arafat. And he saw, Tilyar, that is,
yes,
saw the Palestinian struggle in the PLO and related groups as sort of a seed or an ideological model to be fused with European activists in an anti-American guerrilla war. I wonder if you could develop that further for us.
Well, yeah, this is an extremely important point, because his argument, Tiriot's argument inside the far right, was, well, how can you really simply oppose the far left at a time when the Russians themselves are giving weapons and training and support to groups like the PLO, or the Chinese and the Russians are both courting a group like the PFLP, and they're killing Jews. And the fact that the people who are doing this or supporting this are communists is secondary to the fact that they're anti-American. And when you read Tiriot's writings, he really speaks of the United States as the new Rome, and he sees the United States as such a decadent power, which is infecting Europe, much like Yaki in the earlier period. It's such a bad power that's infecting Europe with terrible things like movies and Coca-Cola and, you know, that kind of thing, that we must really fight the United States at all cost. And this led him, you know, very quickly to an alliance with figures like Saddam Hussein. Now, the other point to remember about Tiriot is that this was actually a major reversal of his earlier position in the 1950s, and I'll just make this brief, but in the late 1950s, he was an extremely significant figure in providing support for the French OAS. And the French OAS was essentially a group of French military people and their supporters who were strongly opposed to letting Algeria attain independence.
By the way, that stands for L'Organisation de la Messe Secrète, the secret army organization.
Yes, yes, and the OAS later mutated into that group.
Right.
And what happened is that Tiriot, like for example, Tiriot was arrested by the Belgian government on a request of the French for suspicion of supporting these underground military people who themselves were planning to assassinate Charles de Gaulle,
mm-hmm.
and actually tried many times. But the great turning point for Tiriot against all this was after two things. One, after France lost Algeria, and also after the Belgians lost control of the Belgian Congo. And he said, look, at this point, we can no longer hold on to the old individual imperialisms of Europe. We must essentially now look at Europe as a united imperium. And in order to do that, we have to jettison all the old ideas, including a simple imitation of Hitlerism and Nazism, including the support for monarchism and support for old colonial attempts to hold on to power. I mean, he made a very significant change, and once he made that change, he and his group, which had networks all across Europe, really took a very significant new turn in the development towards a kind of a left-wing form of fascism.
One of the points to remember here, and one should obviously, in the context of what we've been talking about, guard against ideological oversimplification, but looking at the OAS, who were outraged over the fact that de Gaulle had allowed Algeria to become independent of French colonial rule, it was the FLN, supported by François Genoux, that was fighting for Algerian independence and ultimately became the vehicle for that.
That's exactly right, and there's actually a book called The Red Hand by a guy named Joachim Uesten, I think, which talks about how the French intelligence services were at times very suspicious of the German intelligence services, because the French were afraid that the German intelligence services weren't cracking down enough on FLN weapon conduits from Germany and Switzerland to the FLN. And in fact, there were a whole series of assassinations done by a group called the Red Hand, which was basically a group created by French intelligence to carry out murders against arm dealers who they suspected of being involved in supplying weapons. So the world that someone like a François Genoux lived in, in the 1950s till his death in 1996, I think. I mean, it was a very dangerous world.
And again, one wants to avoid ideological oversimplification. One of the people that Tiriav formed a liaison with, and somebody who I think at least in some ways exemplifies the ideological complexity of some of these things, a guy named Otto Ernst Rehmer. I wonder if you could give us a thumbnail synopsis of his Third Reich career, his post-war SRP ideological oscillation, and then tie Rehmer and Middle East operations and Tiriav together.
Well, probably the best book on Rehmer, or at least in English, to get a summary, is actually Martin Lee's book, The Beast Reawakens, because when he was in Germany, he actually met with Rehmer a few years before Rehmer died.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll get a very good summary there. But Rehmer was a figure who became very prominent in 1944 at the time of the attempted general's coup against Hitler, where von Stauffenberg and other people in the German general staff tried to assassinate Hitler and failed. During the immediate period when it was unclear whether Hitler had survived the bombing attack, Rehmer made sure that in Berlin, the other people in the military were prevented from taking state power. So at a very crucial point when there was a lot of confusion, Rehmer basically stood up for the Führer. And this made him very popular with Hitler, needless to say, after the coup plotters of 44 were basically arrested and then murdered by the Nazis. After the war, Rehmer became a very prominent figure in a group called the SRP, or the Socialist Reich Party. And the SRP was a group that strongly promoted German neutralism and was famous for a slogan called Ohne mich, which means without me. And what that meant is that if the United States was going to have a fight with the Russians, it was going to be without the Germans, that the Germans would not participate in any fight because the Germans were sick of, this is Rehmer, this is the SRP argument,
mm-hmm.
that Germany did not want to be allied with the United States and fight a war with Russia. Now, at that time, the major opponent of the SRP, of course, was Konrad Adenauer, who was, very much supported by America in late 1940s, and Adenauer became the first Chancellor of Germany.
And, of course, the first Chancellor of the Federal Republic.
Exactly.
Right.
And so Adenauer was much hated by the SRP. Now, as a result of the SRP, surprisingly, in the early 1950s, in 1952 in particular, made some significant gains in local German regional elections. I mean, Germany is divided up into different lands or different states, and all these states have independent elections, just like, Wisconsin or Oregon have state elections. And the SRP made a very significant win. They got about, I think, 14% of the vote in one of the electoral Landers. And it frightened the German government, and also frightened both the British and the Americans. And so very quickly, the SRP was moved to the position of an illegal party, and Rehmer became a subject of arrest. And so I also should point out here that actually, if you look at it, one reason why the SRP did so well is because so many Germans were so exhausted by the threat of war that anyone promising a German uninvolvement in any war had a certain amount of popularity. There's also a very good discussion of the attempts of the SRP to make overtures with pacifist and communist elements in a book by a man named Kurt Tauber called Beyond Eagle and Swastika. There's also another book by a man named Alistair Horn on post-war Germany, where he also discusses this whole question. And now, the reason why I mention those books is that they also include a discussion of the fact that the SRP itself was getting money from the East Bloc. In other words, people in Eastern Germany, which at that time would be under Russian control, were willing to help finance the SRP because they wanted to encourage as much neutralism as they could. The Russians saw that many of the people on the far right were also themselves extremely anti-communist, and from the Russian standpoint, they were people who were basically being manipulated by the Americans and fighting in the American camp against Soviet interests. So the Russians thought that any attempt to promote any form of neutralism by almost anybody had a sort of a geopolitical plus, for Russia. So during the crackdown of the SRP, it was revealed that the Russians were, in fact, funding elements of the SRP, including Raymer.
Kevin, we're nearing the end of the interview here. If I could ask you just briefly, and perhaps this is an impossibility, but if you could tie Raymer and Tilyar, and again their view of Middle Eastern nationalist movements, and for example PLO and others, as sort of not only an archetype but a potential ally with Euro-fascists and extreme leftists against the U.S.
Well, the key thing it's sort of easy to tie in both of them because they both advocated what was called a Rapallo policy publicly, and a Rapallo policy was the idea of Germany aligning with Russia. This was a reference to the Rapallo Agreement, the Rapallo Accord in the 1920s, when Germany did in fact briefly do just that.
Sure.
They also are allied in the fact that they both spent extensive time in the Middle East. And Raymer, for example, was involved. He moved to Syria. He spent time in Egypt training members of the Egyptian military. Just as Tilyar in the 1960s spent extensive time in the Middle East. So they both had a very pan-Arabist orientation. At the same time, they were identified as being very pro a Russian-German alliance, what I think Raymer at one point called the Bismarck Initiative.
And again, they saw these Middle Eastern groups as something of a not only an ally, but as a pattern for combined extreme right and extreme left cooperation against the United States.
Absolutely.
All righty. Well, we have been speaking with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki, and the Postwar Fascist International. That book is published in softcover by Autono Media. You can visit their website at www.autonomedia.com. org. Kevin is also the author of a summary of a book called Schmutzige Geschäfte und Heiliger Krieg, Al-Qaeda on Europa, by Johannes and Germania von Donani. That book obviously was published in German, published in Switzerland by Pendo Verlag from Zurich of 2002, tying in many of the things we've been talking about, Ahmed Huber, the Muslim Brotherhood, which we touched on in our last talk. And I have accessed just about that whole paper in several recent For the Record programs, and much of the text is reproduced in the written descriptions for those programs. Now, having mentioned that, let me remind listeners that the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com not only carries real audio, but features long article-length descriptions of each program, and we'll have a description for the Record program number 383 within a week or so of the airing of the broadcast. Also, be aware that sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the real the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older programs for download only at a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org Dave Emery web URL and to the Spitfire website as well. By the way, Kevin Coogan's magnum opus, Dreamer of the Day, was edited by Dave Mandel, an on-air personality at WFMU. Kevin, it's been a pleasure and very enlightening once again to visit with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All